happy Sabbath. Well, it is a happy Sabbath, isn't it? It's a happy Sabbath for a lot of reasons. One of which, we find ourselves here in a beautiful part of a beautiful state, do we not? On very, very historic territory. It's a privilege to be here. Another good reason it's a happy Sabbath is that the Lord is coming soon. How can we wait? Well, when I was last here with you in Carolina, I had a young man help me out up front, and some of you have asked, where did he go? Well, here's where he went. He's done a little growing since last we were together. But today I want Richard to help me out in exactly the way he did over at Junaluska the last time we were together here. I want him to give us one of the best reasons in the world as to why we're here this morning. And we're going to need this microphone on so he can share that with us.
As far as joining the list, it's important to learn. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days, Shabbat later, and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger, which is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Exodus 20:8-11.
Well, thank you, Richard. And now we've heard the law on the subject, have we not? Very good reason for being here. You know, for virtually all of our 150-year history as a people, at least some Adventists have understood about the Sabbath. You folk realize it was as early as the spring of 1844 when the first Millerite Adventist began to rediscover something called the Seventh-day Sabbath. And for most of that time, Adventists have believed that there would come a time in which the Sabbath would become a defining issue, a catalyst that would propel the world into its final moment of choice, the entire human race in a relatively short period of time would have to make that terribly important decision. Have I learned my lesson about rebellion? Will I take salvation on God's terms? Or will I, like most of the people throughout the history of the world, insist on trying to do it myself in my own way and thus perpetuate a terrible rebellion? Well, for most of that 150 years, it has been Adventist eschatology that the Sabbath would become a major issue, a major crisis at the end of time. And this morning, let's ask ourselves a question. Is that old Victorian idea that goes way deep into the 19th century, that idea that the Sabbath, a day of worship, could become an end time issue, is that still relevant in the late 20th century? In an era in which we have Sunday football and shopping malls open 7 days a week, how could a day of worship ever become an issue in an era like this? Could it ever happen? Well, we've listened to ourselves for a lot of decades on that issue. This morning I suggest perhaps it would be time to get a second opinion. Let's listen to somebody outside of Adventism, and let's see if, in fact, a day of worship could be an end-time issue. And the person from whom I solicit a second opinion this morning is someone known to a lot of people in this country as the Reverend Pat Robertson. A couple of years ago, he wrote a book entitled The New World Order. Let me share with you just a few sentences from Pat Robertson's book. I'm beginning on page 233. It is one of the supreme ironies of history that the former communist bloc nations are desperately seeking to repair the moral wreckage brought upon them by atheism, while irreligious liberal groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State are doing everything in their power to drive the United States back into the same moral abyss that the East Bloc countries are clawing out of. The Ten Commandments are for our own good. As Jesus Christ put it, the Sabbath was made for man. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Our minds, our spirits, and our bodies demand a regular time of rest. Perhaps God's greatest gift to mankind is the ability to be free from work one day a week. But laws in America that mandated a day of rest have been nullified as a violation of the separation of church and state. In modern America, shopping centers, malls, and stores carry on their frantic pace 7 days a week. Before our eyes, we watch the increase of chronic burnout, stress breakdown, mental and spiritual exhaustion cauterizing the souls of our people. I never gave the issue of a day of rest much thought until I read God's spoken word through the prophet Isaiah. And then would you like to guess what text Pat Robertson quotes? Isaiah 58. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth. Now, on page 237 of his book, The New World Order, Pat Robertson concludes these thoughts by saying that when he had read this reminder of the importance of the Sabbath day, he says, and I quote, "I determined to make my Sundays according to the biblical model." Pat Robertson. Now, wait a second, folks. Pat Robertson can read Isaiah 58 and see the word Sabbath and think of Sunday. And when he does, he expresses himself in some pretty tough language, cauterizing our souls. Irreligious liberal groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Say, by the way, do you know who that is? Do you know who Americans United was started by? Seventh-day Adventists. Pat Robertson reads these things and he thinks of Sunday. Do you have any hint of end-time trouble here? And honestly enough, we read Isaiah 58, and when we hear the word Sabbath, what do we think of? We think of the seventh day. Now, how in the world could such confusion enter into the Christian church? How in the world do you lose track of a whole day? Well, I think there's an answer. I think the answer may be found in the text that Pat just quoted in his book. Let's go back to it, the same text we heard read so well this morning for our scripture reading. And I'm going to share it with you now in another couple of versions so that we will simply have a wider view of the same thing. New American Standard Version and the New English Bible. Listen to Isaiah 58:12. "And those from among you shall rebuild the ancient ruins. You shall raise up the age-old foundations and shall be called repairer of the breach and the restorer of streets in which to dwell." Now, what is Isaiah saying here? Seems quite obvious that he's saying that somewhere, sometime, some vital truth is going to be lost. It'll come down like a building falling down. When it disappears, it will leave something notably missing in your life. Some vital truth. It's vital, like the wall of a walled city. And when it disappears, it leaves the defenses of your soul open to attack. Somebody is going to have to come along and rediscover that fortress of truth and rebuild on very, very old foundations. Well, the next question, of course, that we would ask would be, well, what truth is it that gets lost and has to be rediscovered? And fortunately, Isaiah tells us in the very next verse, Isaiah 58:13, "If you cease to tread the Sabbath underfoot and keep my holy day free from your own affairs, call the Sabbath a day of joy and the Lord's holy day. If you honor it by not plying your trade or seeking your own interest or attending to your own affairs, then you shall find your joy in the Lord, and I will set you on the heights of the earth." The truth that has to be rediscovered after it is lost is the truth of the Sabbath. In other words, Isaiah predicts something. Somewhere in the history of God's people on this earth, the Sabbath for a while gets lost, and then it gets rediscovered. Now let's watch that happen. Because the way it happened very well could still be an end time issue that you and I and 6 billion other people on this planet will have to face and will have to decide on in a very short period of time, probably in a time of real world crisis. Turn with me, if you would like to the book of Acts. Seems clear to me that deep into the first century AD, the Sabbath was still very much alive and well, long after Jesus returned to heaven, long after the start of the early Christian church. And I invite you to look at Acts 16, beginning here with verse 11. Paul's just telling the story of how they left one place and went to another place and what they did when the Sabbath came. Acts 16:11. Loosing from Troas, we came with a straight course to Samothracia, and the next day to Neapolis, and from thence to Philippi. And on the Sabbath day we went out of the city by a riverside where prayer was wont to be made. Now what's happening here? Paul the evangelist is on a missionary journey. He's far from home. He finds himself in a strange city on the Sabbath day, and what does Paul want to do? Wants to find a quiet, lovely place in nature where he can worship his Lord. The Apostle Paul, as late as 53 AD, was a Sabbath keeper. Now, I know that lots of times people will say, well, you know, Paul went to the synagogue on the Sabbath. That's because he wanted to preach to Jews, and that's where you find Jews. And so naturally, he went to synagogue, but that doesn't prove that he was really worshiping on the Sabbath. Well, I got news for you, folk. This ain't a synagogue, is it? It's a riverbank. And there he prayed, and there he found some godly women to witness to, and there he kept the Sabbath. Well, not only was the Sabbath alive and well deep into the first half of the first century AD, as late as the end of the first century, the Sabbath is still being kept by the apostles, those who were left, and there are very few of them by now. There's only one, and that's John the Revelator. And I invite you to turn with me to John's book of Revelation, the Revelation of Jesus Christ, and we'll begin here in chapter 1, down here, right around verse 9. And I, John, who also am your brother and companion in tribulation, was in that isle called Patmos for the word of God, and I was in the Spirit on what day? On the Lord's day. Now, what day is the Lord's day? Now, I know we have lots of wonderful Christian brothers and sisters around us in our neighborhoods and in our hometowns, who on Sunday get dressed up in their nicest clothes and their nicest jewelry, and they drive off to church and they say, we're going to worship Jesus on the Lord's Day. And I respect their conviction, and I thank the Lord for people who care enough about the Lord to want to go to church. Don't you? But you know, when it comes to forming biblical theology, it's kind of important to let the Bible speak for itself, isn't it? Rather than to let a 20th century term dictate to us what we believe the Bible to be saying. John the Revelator says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. Now what does Mark 2:27 and 28 say the Lord's Day is? Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Therefore what? The Son of Man is Lord also of what? The Sabbath day. And when Jesus gives advice to his people just before he leaves this world to return to heaven, he tells them downstream in time, terrible things are coming. There will be an attack on Jerusalem, the likes of which you cannot imagine. Pray. Pray that when it happens and you have to flee, that doesn't occur on what day? On the Sabbath day. No wonder Paul was a Sabbath keeper. Jesus told him to. That's pretty good authority, isn't it? So deep into the first century AD, the Sabbath is still alive and well. But Isaiah says this is going to disappear. We're going to lose this truth, and someone will have to come along and rediscover and rebuild a fortress of truth that is a protection for your soul. So when and how was the Sabbath lost? Well, I've got news for you. It didn't disappear quickly. As late as the 4th century A.D., deep into the 4th century, it is clear the Sabbath was still being observed by Christians because an increasingly powerful coalition of church and state, which by now was beginning to adopt a day of rest of its own creation, found it necessary to have a council in a place called Laodicea. They had a church council. One of the things that worried them was that there were still Sabbath-keeping Christians, and they wanted to have uniformity of a day of worship. And so in 364 AD, at the Council of Laodicea, this particular political and religious body passed a rule, and I read it to you exactly as it was worded, that members of the church should not rest on the Sabbath day like the Jews, but should work on that day, preferring in honor the Lord's Day. So our term, the Lord's Day, comes not from the Bible, you see, in that sense, but from a church council of what is becoming the Roman Catholic Church. And I have to stop now, and I say not only thank the Lord for Baptists, who have been so kind as to share their facilities with us here today, but I want to say thank the Lord for Roman Catholics. Now, I may shock you by saying that, but I've spent 7 years of my life on a Roman Catholic campus getting 3 graduate degrees. And see, folk, I see them not just as statistics, I see them as human beings. And I see a lot of Catholics who love Jesus. You know something, Catholics make wonderful Adventists. They really do. So thank the Lord for them. I love the Catholic people too. I can't help but love them because I was with them for so long. But notice what happens here in 364 A.D. Somebody is trying to wipe the Sabbath out of Christian life. Notice something else. Within about 40 years of that edict that was passed at Laodicea, the Roman Empire suffers one of the last savage attacks that will doom it to the dustbin of history. New Year's Eve, 406 A.D., that mighty Hun force comes roaring in out of Germany. Terrified defenders fall back in front of that force. They fall back into the Iberian Peninsula, into Spain. And within about 100 years after the Sabbath is doomed by this council at Laodicea, the Roman Empire is gone. Now, there's an interesting coincidence I see here in history. What happened to Israel when they forgot how to keep the Sabbath? Great armies of Babylon swept westward across the desert, and Nebuchadnezzar II took Israel captive, dispersed them out into Babylon. When the Roman Empire, which is now professing to be a religious empire, loses sight of the Sabbath, what happens? They disappear from history. And so the Sabbath disappears largely right around the beginning of what we call the Dark Ages. Now let me stop here and ask a question that is so important that I have to take the time to ask it. What is so special about the Sabbath day? Why is it so important that when it disappears, Isaiah says it is as though a city has lost its walls. There's just nothing left but foundation stones in the weeds. And it is as though the defenses of the soul are now open to attack. Why would the Sabbath be such a valuable defense? Well, I've given a lot of thought to that. Let me offer one suggestion that you may find some value in. It seems to me that the Sabbath day is an ironclad armor plate defense against one of the worst human weaknesses in the world. And that is legalism. See, from the morning of human history, human beings just have not been able to get it through their minds that salvation is a gift from God. We all stubbornly said, well, thanks for the gift, Lord, but isn't there something I can do? Can't I start making bricks and at least build a tower and meet you halfway? And that's called Babel, and that's Babylon, and that's an end time danger. Well, along comes the Sabbath, Shabbat. And it is an absolute defense against human pride and human legalism. And let me explain why I think that is. Go back to the end of creation week, and late on the 6th day of creation, 2 fantastic life forms are looking in wonder at this world the Lord has put them in. 2 beautiful young people. You talk about the archetypical Hollywood couple, young, beautiful, and in love. And you've got Adam and Eve. only on a scale Hollywood could never dream of. So they look around them, and pretty soon the sun starts lowering in the western sky, and evening is drawing on, and evening and morning were what? The seventh day. But wait a second, let me ask you a question. Whose seventh day was this? Was this Adam and Eve's seventh day? Come on, folk, they haven't even been alive for 24 hours yet. The Sabbath will be their first full day, won't it? So the seventh day, Sabbath, is God's seventh day. Now they sit there. I like to imagine that the Creator and those two lovely young people sit by the banks of that big river that flows through Eden. And there they talk. And two young people fall in love with each other and with God in the opening moments of what we will know as Sabbath. Now, I don't know exactly what happened there, but it must have been special. Because something occurred in Eden on that Friday night, the evening of the sixth day, beginning of the seventh day, that seems to have burned its way into the human genes. Don't you notice that there's some sense of wonder that you never quite get over when Friday night comes along and the sun hits the western horizon and everything stops? You close your insurance office or your dental office, or you park your tractor and your combine. All the problems of the week just melt away. They can't follow you there because there's a wall in the way. There's a defense for your soul. And there's something just magical about Friday night. Or am I the only Adventist in this group that's ever sensed that? Huh? Do you sense that? I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to walk away from Adventism. Now, thank the Lord you folk aren't troubled back here where you got both feet on the ground. But out in California where I come from, there are getting to be Adventists who are culturally very happy to be part of the church. They're used to it. They're used to gluten steaks. They're used to Sabbath. But increasingly, they aren't real comfortable with some of the old-fashioned standards of the church. And so some folk out where I come from may sometimes get discouraged with Adventism. Sometimes we fail the Lord. We may find the dress standards of this church kind of an archaic relic out of the Victorian era. We may find the spirit of prophecy a little bit too clear when it describes the sins we kind of enjoy. And folk out where I come from, some people even find a glass of vin rosé and a good steak a pretty big temptation. We may get discouraged with the Advent message, but it's hard to walk away from Adventism. Why? Because of Sabbath. Something very special with respect to Sabbath. So on a Friday evening, so special that it would leave forever in the genes of the human race, this love for Sabbath rest, the Creator and His children celebrate the first Sabbath together. Now let me cut to the point that I'm trying to make here. I've told you that I think the Sabbath is an absolute defense against legalism. Notice something. Before Adam and Eve ever face even a full day of work, what is it they first do? They first rest in Jesus. That is righteousness by faith. That's how your soul gets saved here, and that's how their souls would have stayed saved there. Folk, there's only one righteousness, there's only one salvation in this world. It's righteousness by faith. So Adam and Eve rest in the Lord, and out of this comes rich symbolism. Nothing we ever do, there's no human work that ever buys us heaven. Now, surprisingly enough, that's been a terribly hard lesson for even Christians to learn. You know, the world is full of people trying to earn heaven, doing endless pilgrimages. Some of them sleep on beds and nails. Some of them walk on fire. Some of them, whom I know quite well, do decades of rosaries and acts of contrition. And all of that, I respectfully suggest, is human works. Now, let me suggest something. I think the ultimate example of salvation by human works would be to tell the Lord, look, I have created for you a special day upon which you are going to get honored, when God has already given us a day. What was the mistake Cain made in the morning of human history? Not that he didn't want to worship, not that he didn't want to sacrifice. He said, Lord, I'm going to do something that I've created here. I don't have nothing to do with sheep or goats or lambs, but I do grow beautiful vegetables. I would like to bet that Cain's offering was the most perfect fruit and vegetable basket you'll ever see in this world. He brought the best he could find to the Lord, but he heard only silence from heaven. So it seems to me that maybe a good example of legalism would be to say, Lord, look what we've done to glorify you. We've created a day of worship. Folks, that is like building a bonfire to glorify the sun. Let's get real. The Lord has given us something in which he wants to be glorified. And it's called Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath forces us to give up on self and human works and rest instead in the righteousness of Christ and take salvation on God's terms and not our own. Thus, it protects us from ourselves. So, as the Middle Ages progressed, the Sabbath was almost forgotten, and the Christian church showed it. I mean, there was horrifying corruption in the church. There were rival popes. There were religious wars. There was immorality that is unprintable, that occurred as high up as behind the bronze doors of the papal apartments. You cannot believe the level of immorality that crept into a church once we decided we were going to give up on the gospel as God gave it to us and write one of our own. But God had, through Isaiah, promised that the Sabbath would be rediscovered. And I suggest that if ever there was a time that the Sabbath needed to be rediscovered, it was about now, when the church was at its low point and people had lost sight of holiness. And God began to move. And over in England, there were little groups of people, devout Bible students, who loved the Lord and who loved their church, but looked around themselves and found the church to be not nearly what God wanted it to be. So they said, it's time for us to purify the Church of England. And because this was what they called for, they were called Puritans. And the Puritans began to study, and guess what they discovered in the Word? That all of these holy days, 152 holy days that were imposed on people during the Middle Ages, in addition to the weekly Sunday services, meant nothing if you didn't know how to keep God's day properly. And in the Bible, they rediscovered that the day of rest should be kept from sundown to sundown, that it should be used for worship and study and instructing your children and doing good deeds to others. In other words, this little group of Puritans began to rediscover the right way to keep the Sabbath. Now, they didn't have the right day, but they were rediscovering the right way. Interestingly enough, they were terribly persecuted. They fled to Holland. Finally, they said, there's one hope left for us. There's a new continent out west, about 3,000 miles across the ocean. If we can get there, maybe we'll have the freedom to live our faith and keep our Sabbath the way we want to. Of course, they were still Sunday-keeping Christians. So they chartered a couple of boats. One of them was called the Mayflower. The other one was badly misnamed because it was called the Speedwell. And it didn't. It was so leaky, you wouldn't dare try to cross the ocean on it. The Speedwell had to stay behind, but all 102 of them got on the Mayflower. And right around Christmas Day, the day after Christmas, I think it was, 1620, they put ashore on that little rock that sticks up on the coast of Massachusetts. In other words, America was founded in that area by people who just wanted to keep the Sabbath. Their Sabbath. Well, whenever people study the Bible that carefully, it's inevitable they're going to bump into more truth. And so it was in the 17th century. And these Puritans who were rediscovering the way to keep the Sabbath soon, in some little isolated places, began to rediscover the day. They discovered the seventh-day Sabbath. And here and there, these bands of Sabbath keepers began to arise. And they came into history under the title of Seventh-day Baptists. That's why I'm so grateful to the Baptist Church, what the Baptists have helped to share with us. We learned about the Sabbath from the Baptists. We didn't get it from them, we got it from the Word of God. But a Seventh-day Baptist woman by the name of Rachel Oakes Preston helped us rediscover something very precious. Well, over in England, the Sabbath was observed by little groups of people. But it wasn't very prominent. What it needed was to be exposed to the world in a much more prominent way. And right around that time, something happened in America. In America in the 1840s, a band of people arose who were so vocal and so insistent and so aggressive that you couldn't ignore them. These people were called Adventists, and the message that they bore was about as subtle as a trumpet blast. They were running around the world telling everyone Jesus was coming. Behold, the bridegroom cometh. Go ye out to meet him. And if the Sabbath truth could reach these people, they would in turn take it to the world. That's the kind of people they were. Well, it reached them as early as the springtime of 1844. By 1846, they had done something with the Sabbath no one had ever done before. They had linked the ancient biblical Sabbath with end-time events that would occur just before Jesus came, and thus they became not only Sabbath keepers, but they became a group of people who would force the world to confront the issue of legalism just before the advent of Christ. Now notice something here in Revelation. Let's turn over to Revelation 14, verse 8. And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The folks who call themselves Adventists and who would rediscover the Sabbath with the help of their Baptist sister would also link the Sabbath truth with an end-time danger called the fall of Babylon. Now, what does that all mean? What message is encrypted in that reference in the Bible to an end-time error called Babylon? Well, to answer that question, you have to ask one, don't you? Where was Babylon and what happened there? What did people do in Babylon right after the flood? It's been a while since I took Hebrew history in academy, but maybe I can remember back that far. In the place where we now find the ruins of ancient Babylon, is it not true that soon after the flood, a generation of people gathered there and built a great metropolis? They were fully aware of God's promise that a flood would never happen again. But they said, just in case he changes his mind, what shall we do? Build a tower. Brick by brick by brick, a perfect example of human beings trying to create salvation through their own works. A perfect repetition of the mistake Cain made. I think a perfect illustration of otherwise good Christian people meaning to do well, who without realizing the significance of what they're doing, create a day of worship when God has already given them one. In other words, Babylon is at bottom legalism, an attempt to be saved based on your own activity, your own thought process, your own works. So at the end of time, this group of people will warn the world, come out of Babylon, you'll never save yourself, and you don't have much time left to get saved even by Jesus, because his coming is approaching and you're racing towards something called the close of probation. Come out of Babylon, my people. Now that's why I think that we should never ever look on people of another church as our competitors or as our antagonists, because folk, most of them are still out there. Most of God's people are out there in these other churches. Why else would he say, come out of her, my people? He's calling his people into greater truth. So at the end of time, God's people who rediscover the Advent and the Sabbath put it all together and they warn the world about an end-time danger that is symbolized by the self-worship you find in Babylon. How are they able to do all of this? Because alone, of all of the Sabbath-keeping Christian denominations in the world, this group called Seventh-day Adventists also understands something called a heavenly sanctuary. All of the other Sabbath-keeping churches that began to arise around the time of the William Miller movement and following it remain fairly small. Adventism, with its understanding of the sanctuary, took the Sabbath truth into a coordinated, truthful whole. Now, it seems to me that Adventists, having made the Sabbath an end-time truth, have done something with it nobody else has ever done. Our Jewish friends see Shabbat as a beautiful memorial of creation, but they're not looking forward to the second coming of Jesus. Our Seventh-day Church of God and Seventh-day Baptist friends see the Sabbath as a rule from Sinai. But they have not put it into an end-time context that will challenge the world at the end of time to make a decision for or against rebellion. And if the Sabbath is not preached in an end-time context, it seems to me it loses its power. Now, early in her work, Ellen White heard a minister who was preaching the Sabbath truth and doing a very fine job of it in terms of referring back to Sinai and Eden. But he wasn't making it an end-time truth. He wasn't stressing its end-time significance. Talked about good things, but not the best things. In other words, he was preaching Sabbath without its end-time urgency. And Mrs. White had this to say to him. You can find it, if you want to look it up for yourself, in Volume 1 of Testimonies for the Church, page 337. Elder Kay knows not of what spirit he is. As far as the Sabbath is concerned, he occupies the same position as the Seventh-day Baptists. Separate the Sabbath from the three angels' messages, and it loses its power. The Sabbath is an end-time truth. And so a fortunate end-time group gets the chance to tell all of that to the world. And we find ourselves the ones upon whom that spotlight now shines. And now let's go back to Isaiah 58. And those from among you shall rebuild the ancient ruins. You shall raise up the age-old foundations, and you will be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the paths in which to dwell. Sadly enough, when that message is articulated to the world very clearly, most of the world will rebel. It will turn out to be the case that most of the world has not learned their lesson about legalism. And the Sabbath will provoke the worst crisis this world has ever seen. John the Revelator put it very clearly, if very briefly, in Revelation 12:17, and the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed who keep the commandments of God. Daniel, in his closing chapter, Daniel 12, gives us a little insight into how bad this world crisis will get. As he says, and at that time shall Michael, a great prince, stand up which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was. And this morning as we close, I go back to the fascinating and in many ways rather logical appeal of a man by the name of Pat Robertson. And I hear him say that it is one of the supreme ironies of history that the former communist nations are desperately seeking to repair the moral wreckage brought on their nations by atheism, while irreligious liberal groups like Americans United for the Separation of Church and State are doing all in their power to pull America back into the abyss the East Bloc nations are clawing their way out of. Before our eyes, we watch the increase of chronic burnout, stress breakdowns, nervous disorders, mental and spiritual exhaustion cauterizing the souls of our people. Laws in America that mandated a day of rest from commerce have been nullified as a violation of the separation between church and state. Listen carefully this early afternoon, my fellow Adventists. Because in the words of Pat Robertson's book, I can detect a declaration of war against the Constitution. And they that shall be of thee shall rebuild the ancient places. If you cease to dread the Sabbath underfoot and call my holy day free from your own affairs, if you call the Sabbath a day of joy, if you honor it by not plying your trade, nor seeking your own interest, nor attending to your own affairs, then you shall find your joy in the Lord, and I will set you riding on the heights of the earth, where the world has to see the truth.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.